intimidated after that display of talent. I couldn't come up with anything. those five words. Just drivel, really. So I should probably just sit down again. Anyway, it's lovely to be here in Cork City, and thank you so much for having me. And thanks to Paul for hosting me. And I was very intrigued. I caught some of the poetry films earlier, and I've never had that exciting experience of working with a filmmaker and having my poems come to life in that way. But this summer I had a sort of kind of exciting collaboration of a slightly different kind, in that I was contacted by a pianist and composer who asked, would it be okay if I set some of your poems to music? Great. She had a commission to create a couple of new pieces and was going to give concerts, and was working with a sound technician and a singer. So she took three of my poems and set them to music. And she had this incredible sort of double piano situation. One of the pianos she had sort of taken the top off and put a whole load of nails and screws and bits of blue tack in between strings to create different sounds. So she had one piano that was just your ordinary classic piano, and then this different, made for her own purpose, messed around with irreverently piano, which created a very interesting combination. So I thought I would read you those three poems. Her commission was to create music around the theme of home. And for her, as she lives in the same borough as I do, which is Dunleary, a suburb of Dublin, it's right by the sea. So for her, as for me, home means being by the sea. So these are three watery poems, and you'll get a sense that I always go back to the water. It's a very important source, muse, if you like, for me. I'm sure all of you have your own sort of special Dinchampus for your work. For me, it's the sea. So the first one I'm going to read is called Sunset, and it's set right by the sea in Dunleary on the pier, the West Pier. In the pink embrace of the icy sunset, the hills arching their dark backs to a last blue and peach caress, we marveled at the lingering golden-tinged evening, how it lit up the sea, the red boats. In that final illumination, we let each other go, our hearts sinking like the exhausted sun after the orchestra of light. So I love swimming in the sea as well. This next poem is called Dip, and it's set in White Rock, which is the closest beach to my house. And it was written about one of those sort of sneaky extra swims that you manage to fit in at the end of a long working day. I've just been in the office for the whole day, but I still managed to get a swim. Dip. Scuff down sandy steps, arches, stipple and sink on crunchy, damp stones, shell rims. Toes, naked pink, lead the wade, skin gasping, going down into grey-green thick of salt. Shiver of wave tip on thigh, belly, breast, up to the chin. Hair ends, ribboning, white arms marked with the cling of magenta fronds. Eyes rove to whale hump of mountain, pink and yellow of shore blossom, the island goldening up out of the mirror ball bay. My play body needs no virtual reality, only this late summer dip in the sea. So this last of the three is called August. I've never been very good at titles. Also set in the West Pier, about a going out in kayaks with my two children. Dip your hand into the water. It is warm. Our red and yellow craft, small, tippy kayaks, quiver to swiftness with a few deft paddles swerving between the big boats. A seal's head surfaces, all whiskers and liquid eyes, then dives. The pier walls loom, trailing weed pods. Walkers plonk there, far from our slimline grace. After the lesson, we roll right into the water, bobbing in our sleek suits as the sea reclaims our limbs, as the sky lowers its soft evening. They sounded so different when they were sung by this wonderful throaty singer who's actually Ukrainian, with this piano music and a sort of special soundboard that I've never seen before. Anyway, so that was quite something. I'm going to read a sequence of poems now from this most recent collection, Off Duty, which was largely inspired by my husband's illness and death from cancer. And so apologies in advance if some of the poems are a little dark. This poem is called Operation. It was a very long operation to remove a tumour. He had cancer of the nasopharynx. The operation took 12 hours, and he was lucky to survive. In the hospital, gowned in gauzy cloth, he is prepped. His limbs so thin, his head bursting with the tumor, with knowing that wrestling the thing out may kill him. All day the cutters and stitchers are at work, slicing from lip to clavicle, sawing bone, careful not to snick an artery, gouging a flap from his thigh to patch the gap where the tumor hid, thriving in its secret lair. When it's out and they have fixed the jaw with a steel plate, riveted the long L shape of the wound, he lies arrayed with tubes and drains. He floats in the shallows of the anesthetic, his breath echoing eerily from the hole in his throat, his face utterly still. The night before the operation, he read Peter Pan to our children, and in the morning he surrendered, waving from the trolley as if to clutch a last particle of the life we figured for him, as if to let it fall. We never really planned on getting married. Life kind of was too busy for all that, and we were never religious or needing a witness for our commitment to each other, but we were told that we had better get married as he was dying. So this is called Wedding. Hasty, the judge mocked, until he read the letter from the consultant, his jaded face changing to pity. We got the green light then, to marry in a hurry. We turned up in our jeans and limped through the ceremony, upsetting the officiating lady, determined to make this a special occasion. Outside the registry office, we inked a shadow on the next couple, the bride glowing in her plumage, her robust young groom, their flower girls fidgeting. My brother and his wife had used their lunch hour to be our witnesses. They went back to work, and my new spouse rode off on his bike. The big triumph that, with 6 months to live, he could still cycle. I had to collect our children. The paltry nuptials would have been disappointing. No frocks, no fun, just this boring signing thing. And so I kept it secret, left them with Gran. I sloped off to the train. It was bright, a May day, and I was 47. Finally, improbably, a married woman. This one's called The Kitchen. Everything happens in the kitchen, doesn't it? With every portion of food we guzzle, we swell with the taint of the graveyard. And when we laze, we arrange ourselves around stained tissues, bottles of pills, his lank skeletal frame. The worst is when his neck scarf is discarded to release the tumour, pitted and crusted, reeking, a hideous death flower. Still, the children manage to laugh and leap and play, dress-ups and battles, petting the preening cats, settling at last with the Disney comforts of the screen. The end of the sequence now. This poem is called What Can I Give Him? And it's based on that poem in the Bleak Midwinter by Christina Rossetti that is also has been set to music. And this is when my husband was in the hospice and our daughter sang him this song. And it was that cold, cold, snowy winter 2010, and we were also in a recession. She sings with rare confidence, this red-cheeked girl out of a fairy tale, sweet mouth and yellow tumbled locks, performing for her father, rheum-eyed in hospice chair. Adrift in our own midwinter, the grip of fear holds general in our land, so lately garlanded with easy largesse, now gaunt with debt and the worst freeze in years. In this place of death, where his room is empty of all he has been forced to shed, and he is simply grateful for each breath, we have this lift, our shy daughter ablaze in song, and he sits easy, at last a gift he can receive. Bizarre feeling being a widow. One is expected to look and behave in a certain way. That never sits very easy with me. Off duty. Is my face just right? Am I looking as a widow should? I pass the funeral parlour where 4 weeks ago the ceremony unfurled. Now I'm laughing with the children. The director of the solemn place is lolling out front, sucking on a cigarette. We exchange hellos and I blush, remembering how I still haven't paid the bill, how I nearly left that day with someone else's flowers. So I'll just finish this sequence from this particular book with a poem for my son. As I was saying to Paul earlier, I know nothing about sport, I'm terrible. But my son is a soccer player, and so through him I have become more familiar with the whole scene. And this is about a football match that we just about made. One of those difficult to find pitches with a mother who's got no sense of direction. But we just about got there, and it was one of those wonderful games that worked out really well. Winter heroes. It comes to this, a frozen Sunday and a team of six. We almost miss it because I'm lost, sleep deprived, cursing soccer, navigating Drimna. How he races across the field, this boy who's honed his skills, suffered snubs, misses, injuries, lumpy pitches, slanted goalposts, and biased refs. Once he's positioned, the stalled game can proceed. It's Cabo versus Bosco, bony knees and green socks, parents going mental in the raw glare and gusts. His team whirlwinds through mucky tackles, the lack of subs, the unfair penalties, studs hammering across the turf. Winter heroes these, outnumbered, away, they take the game 4-3. So I'm going to move on now and read you some poems from, either new poems or poems from, yeah, they're almost all new. This is where I get really nervous. I suppose I'm a bit of a green. I'm very conscious of what's going on in our planet. And so, here goes. We've all heard these stories about whales. I think the poem speaks for itself. Lost song in the voice of a whale. I navigate drowned forests, coral gardens, the backwash of cruise liners. My swallow drains the tides. I blow fountains. My tail divides the sea. I could last 100 years in this playground, but I fill to starvation with nets, buckets, a snagged lump of plastic cast-offs. I sing my last song, an elegy for my family, for my ocean romps and mighty leaps. A human child finds my drying bulk flabbing on the shore. He looks into my eye, tiny hand petting my flayed skin. I groan in my agony. Poor whale, says the child, you lost your way. This was a film that was going the rounds last winter, I think it was December. Just a very short clip of a starving polar bear that had been filmed on Baffin Island by a man called Paul Macklin. Polar switch from Dublin to Baffin Island, Canada. Collapsing on a bed of stones, his white pelt loose as he starves, slowly, terribly, in a sea of grey. This polar bear is shared, goes viral in his death throes. He's a warning to those few of us who shed tears as the clip is sent around our blind alley of posts and tweets, as we drink hot coffee in our tiny freeze, miles from his thaw. I'm going to read one that is actually from Rootling, because things are never simple. And that includes when one tries to be green. What my hands touch. Every day, drool, excrement, nose snorts, spurts of sick. The vast gushing of water needed to clean up. Wondering how the women cope who have no tap. Every day, baby skin, cat fur, stale bedding, rumpled hair. The vast gushing of water needed to clean up. Wondering how the women cope who have no tap. Every day, my own brittling skin, veiny legs, nails that grow too long, the vast gushing of water needed to clean up, wondering how the women cope who have no tap. Every day, crinkle of old leaves, clouts of earth, errant roots and weeds, the vast gushing of water needed to clean up, wondering how the women cope who have no tap. Every day, greasy plates and bowls, tacky floors and toilet smells, the vast gushing of water needed to clean up, wondering how the women cope who have no tap. Wondering how the world would turn if all these women could turn the water on just as easily as I do. Only the desert would be left. Clean, lifeless vista of endless grains of polished sand. And thank you very much. I'm going to finish with three poems that are all new. Thank you for your attention. Still in the land of women, and these last three poems are very much about women talking. This one's called Loose Talk, and it was inspired by an article in The Guardian. The headline was, "The market for sex dolls is on the rise." So one reads these. I hadn't even known that sex dolls existed. I learned. This is last summer from The Guardian. Loose talk. Nag, prattle, palaver. He's had enough of loud mouth chatter. Better to invest in a lifelike version. A girly robot doll. Great for sex. And a button to press if he wants talk. The deluxe model will laugh at his jokes. Unless she entertains, he prefers the dumb tongue. I'm with the old wives, it's our tales that get told. Silence is false gold if it swallows up assault, incest, rape, medical mistakes. I'll speak as I wish, roses or toads, with the audacious gossips. No secret safe between our lips. Thank you. So this is the last poem I'm going to read. I was given a bit of a challenge. I'm not really one for the classics. But a friend of mine was editing this book dedicated to Ovid and the tales from Metamorphosis. So I reread some of the tales, and I was very taken by the story of Arachne, who was cursed by Minerva, otherwise known as Athena. And you can imagine, Metamorphosis is all about gods raping humans and humans being turned into other things, trees or creatures. But I thought, in a way, Arachne, the classic underdog, cursed, punished by this goddess, this privileged daddy's girl. Arachne somehow won in the end. We all know spiders, we all respect them and fear them. Whereas Minerva tends to be associated with Harry Potter these days. So this is in the voice of Arachne. Arachne's Metamorphosis. I was ready to wring my own neck to avoid the injustice of a rigged contest. I should say the contest was about weaving. Arachne was a much better weaver than this goddess Minerva, and Minerva couldn't handle it. So I was ready to wring my own neck to avoid the injustice of a rigged contest. It was my own fault. I was the challenger, puffed like a cobra, sure of my gift. I should have minded my own beeswax. I, immortal, rearing on a god. She wasn't born humble. She burst out of Jove's head after he'd gobbled her mother. she wove herself into the centre of Daddy's charmed circle, sewed hard to show their awe at her victory in winning the city. She garnished her canvas with punishments meted out to those who refused to knuckle down. I had to laugh at her so-called wisdom, her precious olive branch. What I got was a box in the head when she laid her eyes on my brilliant conjuring of Jove and his shape-changing rapist pals, busy with their brutal deflowering, disguised as eagle, bull, or swan. Furious with envy, reeking with poison, she tore it from my loom. But clinging to the moral high ground, she forced me from my noose, my freedom, distorting my limbs so she could boast of mercy, of reprieve, declare herself mistress of the situation. Left to crawl in the shadow of leaves, I lurk in silk net pumped from my gut. But as I abseil from great heights, spin on my whim, each day a new pattern, my vision of her curse transmogrifies. These days, she's just a statue, solemn, helmet stuck on, no spindle or flashing needle. Even her shield, carved with Medusa's Gordon grimace, hangs quite still. My daughters run wild, many-limbed and eyed. By the time they're born, their fathers have already been devoured. Swift weavers all, expert in the hunt, survivors with their wiles, and much admired. Mother of such girls, I rarely hanker for the old tapestries, frayed and faded in the sun of many days. Dawn offers fresh vistas in the garden, intricate circlets shining with dew, more satisfying than any crown. As Minerva languishes, eroded, barren, with nothing for company but her brittle owls, I declare the contest finished. I've moved on.